Tonight, we come together bound by our faith in a mighty God with genuine respect and love for our country and inheriting the legacy of a great party, the Democratic Party, which is the best hope for redirecting our nation on a more humane, just, and peaceful course. This is not a perfect party. We are not a perfect people. Yet we are called to a perfect mission. Our mission: to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to house the homeless, to teach the illiterate, to provide jobs for the jobless, and to choose the human race over the nuclear race. We are gathered here this week to nominate a candidate and adopt a platform which will expand, unify, direct, and inspire our party and the nation to fulfill this mission. My constituency is the desperate, the damned, the disinherited, the disrespected, and the despised. They are restless and seek relief. They have voted in record numbers. They have invested the faith, hope, and trust that they have in us. The Democratic Party must send them a signal that we care. I pledge my best not to let them down. There is the call of conscience: redemption, expansion, healing, and unity. Leadership must heed the call of conscience: redemption, expansion, healing, and unity, for they are the key to achieving our mission. Time is neutral and does not change things. With courage and initiative, leaders change things. No generation can choose the age or circumstance in which it is born, but through leadership, it can choose to make the age in which it is born an age of enlightenment, an age of jobs and peace and justice. Only leadership, that intangible combination of gifts, discipline, information, circumstance, courage, timing, will, and divine inspiration, can lead us out of the crisis in which we find ourselves. Leadership can mitigate the misery of our nation. Leadership can part the waters and lead our nation in the direction of the promised land. Leadership can lift the boats stuck at the bottom. I've had the rare opportunity to watch seven men and then two pour out their souls, offer their service, and heal and heed the call of duty to direct the course of our nation. There is a proper season for everything. There is a time to sow and a time to reap. There's a time to compete and a time to cooperate. I ask for your vote on the first ballot as a vote for a new direction for this party and this nation. A vote of conviction, a vote of conscience. But I will be proud to support the nominee of this convention for the presidency of the United States of America. I have watched the leadership of our party develop and grow. My respect for both Mr. Mondale and Mr. Hart is great. I've watched them struggle with the crosswinds and crossfires of being public servants, and I believe they will both continue to try to serve us faithfully. I'm elated by the knowledge that for the first time in our history, a woman, Geraldine Ferraro, will be recommended to share our ticket. Throughout this campaign, I've tried to offer leadership to the Democratic Party and the nation. If in my high moments I have done some good, offered some service, shed some light, healed some wounds, rekindled some hope, or stirred some wrong from apathy and indifference, or in any way along the way help somebody, then this campaign has not been in vain. For friends who loved and cared for me, and for a God who spared me, and for a family who understood, I'm eternally grateful. If in my low moments, in word, deed, or attitude, through some error of temper, taste, or tone, I've caused anyone discomfort, created pain, or revived someone's fears, that was not my truest self. If there were occasions when my grape turned into a raisin and my joy bell lost its resonance, please forgive me. Charge it to my head and not to my heart. I am my head, so limited in its finitude, my heart, which is boundless in its love for the human family. I am not a perfect servant. I am a public servant, doing my best against the odds as I develop and serve. Be patient. God is not finished with me yet. This campaign has taught me much, that leaders must be tough enough to fight, tender enough to cry, human enough to make mistakes, humble enough to admit them, strong enough to absorb the pain, and resilient enough to bounce back and keep on moving. For leaders, the pain is often intense, but you must smile through your tears and keep moving with the faith that there's a brighter side somewhere. I went to see Hubert Humphrey 3 days before he died. He had just called Richard Nixon from his dying bed, and many people wondered why. And I asked him. He said, "Jesse, from this vantage point, the sun setting in my life, all of the speeches, the political conventions, the crowds, and the great fights are behind me now. At a time like this, you are forced to deal with your irreducible essence, forced to grapple with that which is really important to you. What I've concluded about life," Hubert Humphrey said, "when all is said and done, we must forgive each other and redeem each other and move on. Our party is emerging from one of its most hard-fought battles for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination in our history. But our healthy competition should make us better, not bitter. We must use the insight, wisdom, and experience of the late Hubert Humphrey as a balm for the wounds in our party, this nation, and the world. We must forgive each other, redeem each other, regroup, and move on. Our flag is red, white, and blue, but our nation is rainbow. Red, yellow, brown, black, and white. We are all precious in God's sight. America is not like a blanket, one piece of unbroken cloth, the same color, the same texture, the same size. America is more like a quilt, many patches, many pieces, many colors, many sizes, all woven and held together by a common thread. The white, the Hispanic, the black, the Arab, the Jew, the woman, the Native American, the small farmer, the business person, the environmentalist, the peace activist, the young, the old, the lesbian, the gay, and the disabled make up the American quilt. Even in our fractured state, all of us count and fit somewhere. We have proven that we can survive without each other, but we have not proven that we can win and make progress without each other. We must come together. From Fannie Lou Hamer in Atlantic City in 1964, to the Rainbow Coalition in San Francisco today, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, we've experienced pain but progress as we ended America's apartheid laws. We got public accommodations. We secured voting rights. We obtained open housing as young people got the right to vote. We lost Malcolm, Martin, Medgar, Bobby, John, and Viola. The team that got us here must be expanded, not abandoned. 20 years ago, tears welled up in our eyes as the bodies of Swerner, Goodman, and Cheney were dredged from the depths of a river in Mississippi. 20 years later, our communities, black and Jewish, are in anguish, anger, and pain. Feelings have been hurt on both sides. There's a crisis in communications. Confusion is in the air. We cannot afford to lose our way. We may agree to agree or agree to disagree on issues. We must bring back stability to these tensions. We are co-partners in a long and rich religious history, the Judeo-Christian traditions. Many blacks and Jews have a shared passion for social justice at home and peace abroad. We must seek a revival of the spirit inspired by a new vision and new possibilities. We must return to higher ground. We are bound by Moses and Jesus, but also connected with Islam and Muhammad. These three great religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, were all born in the revered and holy city of Jerusalem. We are bound by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Rabbi Abraham Heschel, crying out from their graves for us to reach common ground. We are bound by shared blood and shared sacrifices. We are much too intelligent, much too bound by our Judeo-Christian heritage, much too victimized by racism, sexism, militarism, and anti-Semitism. Historical scapegoats to grow on divided one from another. We must turn from finger-pointing to clasp hands. We must share our burdens and our joys with each other once again. We must turn to each other and not on each other and choose higher ground. 20 years later, we could not be satisfied by just restoring the old coalition. Old wineskins must make room for new wine. We must heal and expand. The Rainbow Coalition is making room for Arab Americans. They too know the pain and hurt of racial and religious rejection. They must not continue to be made pariahs. The Rainbow Coalition is making room for Hispanic Americans who this very night are living under the threat of the Simpson-Mazzola bill, and farm workers from Ohio who are fighting the Camel Soup Company with a boycott to achieve legitimate workers' rights. The Rainbow is making room for the Native American, the most exploited people of all, a people with the greatest moral claim amongst us. We support them as they seek the restoration of their ancient land and claim amongst us. We support them as they seek the restoration of land and water rights, as they seek to preserve their ancestral homelands and the beauty of a land that was once all theirs. They can never receive a fair share for all they have given us, but they must finally have a fair chance to develop their great resources and to preserve their people and their culture. The Rainbow Coalition includes Asian Americans now being killed in our streets, scapegoats for the failures of corporate, industrial, and economic policies. The Rainbow is making room for the young Americans. 20 years ago, our young people were dying in a war for which they could not even vote. But 20 years later, young America has the power to stop a war in Central America and the responsibility to vote in great numbers. Young America must be politically active in 1984. The choice is war or peace. We must make room for young America. The rainbow includes disabled veterans. The color scheme fits in the rainbow. The disabled have their handicap revealed and their genius concealed, while the able-bodied have their genius revealed and their disability concealed. But ultimately, we must judge people by their values and their contribution. Don't leave anybody out. I would rather have Roosevelt in a wheelchair than Reagan on a horse. The rainbow is making room for small farmers. They have suffered tremendously under the Reagan regime. They'll either receive 90% parity or 100% charity. We must address their concerns and make room for them. The rainbow includes lesbians and gays. No American citizen ought to be denied equal protection under the law. We must be unusually committed and caring as we expand our family to include new members. All of us must be tolerant and understanding as the fears and anxieties of the rejected and the party leadership express themselves in many different ways. Too often, what we call hate, as if it were some deeply rooted philosophy or strategy, is simply ignorance, anxiety, paranoia, fear, and insecurity. To be strong leaders, we must be long-suffering as we seek to right the wrongs of our party and our nation. We must expand our party, heal our party, and unify our party. That is our mission in 1984. We are often reminded that we live in a great nation, and we do, but it can be greater still. The rainbow is mandating a new definition of greatness. We must not measure greatness from the mansion down, but the manger. Jesus said that we should not be judged by the bark we wear, but by the fruit that we bear. Jesus said that we must measure greatness by how we treat the least of these. President Reagan says the nation is in recovery. Those 90,000 corporations that made a profit last year but paid no federal taxes are recovering. The 37,000 military contractors who have benefited from Reagan's more than doubling the military budget in peacetime, surely they are recovering. The big corporations and rich individuals who received the bulk of the three-year multi-billion tax cut from Mr. Reagan are recovering. But no such recovery is on the way for the least of these. Rising tides don't lift all boats, particularly those stuck at the bottom. For the boats stuck at the bottom, there's a misery index. This administration has made life more miserable for the poor. Its attitude has been contemptuous. Its policies and programs have been cruel and unfair to working people. They must be held accountable in November for increasing infant mortality among the poor. In Detroit, one of the great cities of the Western world, babies are dying at the same rate as Honduras, the most undeveloped nation in our hemisphere. This administration must be held accountable for policies that contribute to growing poverty in America. There are now 34 million people in poverty, 15% of our nation, 23 million are white, 11 million black, Hispanic, Asian, and others, mostly women and children. By the end of this year, there will be 41 million people in poverty. We cannot stand idly by. We must fight for change now. Under this regime, we look at Social Security. The 81 budget cuts included 9 permanent Social Security benefit cuts totaling $20 billion over 5 years. Small businesses have suffered under Reagan tax cuts. Only 18% of total business tax cuts went to them, 82% to big business. Health care under Mr. Reagan has been sharply cut. Education under Mr. Reagan has been cut 25%. Under Mr. Reagan, there are now 9.7 million female head families. They represent 16% of all families. Half of all of them are poor. 70% of all poor children live in a house headed by a woman where there is no man. Under Mr. Reagan, the administration has cleaned up only 6 of 546 priority toxic waste dumps. Farmers' real net income was only about half its level in 1979. Many say that the race in November will be decided in the South. President Reagan is depending on the conservative South to return him to office. But the South, I tell you, is unnaturally conservative. The South is the poorest region in our nation and therefore the least to conserve. In his appeal to the South, Mr. Reagan is trying to substitute flags and prayer cloths for food and clothing and education, health care and housing. Mr. Reagan will ask us to pray, and I believe in prayer. I've come this way by the power of prayer. But then we must watch false prophecy. He cuts indigent assistance to the poor, cut breakfast programs from children, cut lunch programs from children, cut job training from children, and then say to an empty table, let us pray. Apparently, he is not familiar with the structure of a prayer. You thank the Lord for the food that you're about to receive, not the food that just left. I think that we should pray, but don't pray for the food that left. Pray for the man that took the food to leave. We need a change. We need a change in November. Under Mr. Reagan, the misery index has risen for the poor. The danger index has risen for everybody. Under this administration, we've lost the lives of our boys. A nuclear standoff in Europe. Under this administration, 1/3 of our children believe they will die in a nuclear war. The danger index is increasing in this world. With all the talk about the defense against Russia, the Russian submarines are closer and their missiles are more accurate. We live in a world of night more miserable and the world more dangerous. While Reaganomics and Reaganism is talked about often, so often we miss the real meaning. Reaganism is a spirit. Reaganomics represent the real economic facts of life. In 1980, Mr. George Bush, a man with reasonable access to Mr. Reagan, did an analysis of Mr. Reagan's economic plan. Mr. George Bush concluded that Reagan's plan was voodoo economics. He was right. Third party candidate John Anderson said a combination of military spending, tax cuts, and a balanced budget by 84 would be accomplished with blue smoke and mirrors. They were both right. Mr. Reagan talks about a dynamic recovery. There's some measure of recovery. 3.5 years later, unemployment has inched just below where it was when he took office in 81. There are still 8.1 million people officially unemployed, 11 million working only part-time. Inflation has come down, but let's analyze for a moment who paid the price for the superficial economic recovery. Mr. Reagan curbed inflation by cutting consumer demand. He cut consumer demand with conscious and callous fiscal and monetary policies. He used the federal budget to deliver and curb social spending. He then waived and supported tight monetary policies of the Federal Reserve Board to deliberately drive up interest rates, again to curb consumer demand created through borrowing. Unemployment reached 10.7%. We experienced skyrocketing interest rates, our dollar inflated abroad, there were record bank failures, record farm foreclosures, record business bankruptcies, record budget deficits, record trade deficits. Mr. Reagan brought inflation down by destabilizing our economy and disrupting family life. He promised in 1980 a balanced budget, but instead we now have a record $200 billion budget deficit. Under Mr. Reagan, the cumulative budget deficit for his four is more than the sum total of deficits from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. I tell you, we need a change. How is he paying for these short-term jobs? Reagan's economic recovery is being financed by deficit spending, $200 billion a year. Military spending, a major cause of this deficit, is projected over the next 5 years to be nearly $2 trillion and will cost about $40,000 for every taxpaying family. When the government borrows $200 billion annually to finance the deficit, this encourages the private sector to make its money off of interest rates as opposed to development and economic growth. Even money abroad, we don't have enough money domestically to finance the debt, so we are now borrowing money abroad from foreign banks, governments, and financial institutions. $40 billion in 1983, $70 to $80 billion in 1984, 40% of our total, over $100 billion, 50% of our total in 1985. By 1989, it is projected that 50% of all individual income taxes will be gone just to pay for interest on that debt. The United States used to be the largest exporter of capital, but under Mr. Reagan, we will quite likely become the largest debtor nation. About 2 weeks ago, on July the 4th, we celebrated our Declaration of Independence. Yet every day, supply-side economics is making our nation more economically dependent and less economically free. 5 to 6% of our gross national product is now being eaten up with President Reagan's budget deficits. To depend on foreign military powers to protect our national security would be foolish, making us dependent and less secure. Yet Reaganomics has us increasingly dependent on foreign economic sources. This consumer-led but deficit finance recovery is unbalanced and artificial. We have a challenge as Democrats to point a way out. Democracy guarantees opportunity, not success. Democracy guarantees the right to participate, not a license for either a majority or a minority to dominate. The victory for the Rainbow Coalition in the platform debates today was not whether we won or lost, but that we raised the right issues. We could afford to lose the vote. Issues are negotiable. We cannot afford to avoid raising the right questions. Our self-respect and our moral integrity were at stake. Our heads are perhaps bloody, but not bowed. Our back is straight. We can go home and face our people. Our vision is clear. We think on this journey from slave ship to championship, we've gone from the planks of the boardwalk in Atlantic City in 1964 to fighting to help right the planks in the platform in San Francisco in 84. There is a deep and abiding sense of joy in our souls in spite of the tears in our eyes. Though there are missing planks, there is a solid foundation upon which to build. Our party can win, but we must provide hope which will inspire people to struggle and achieve. Provide a plan that shows a way out of our dilemma and then lead the way. In 1984, my heart is made to feel glad because I know there is a way out. Justice. The requirement for rebuilding America is justice. The linchpin of progressive politics in our nation will not come from the North. They, in fact, will come from the South. That is why I argue over and over again. We look from Virginia around to Texas. There's only one black congressperson out of 115. 19 years later, we're locked out the Congress, the Senate, and the governor's mansion. What does this large black vote mean? Why do I fight to end second primaries and fight gerrymandering and annexation and that large? Why do we fight over that? Because I tell you, you cannot hold someone in the ditch unless you linger there with them. Unless you linger there. If you want to change in this nation, you enforce that Voting Rights Act, we'll get 12 to 20 black, Hispanic, female, and progressive congresspersons from the South. We can save the cotton, but we got to fight the vote weevils. We got to make a judgment. Hope ERA will pass. How can we pass ERA? If blacks vote in great numbers, progressive whites win. It's the only way progressive whites win. If blacks vote in great numbers, Hispanics win. When blacks, Hispanics, and whites vote, women win, children win. When women and children win, workers win. We must all come up together. We must come up together. Excitement. We must not save the world and lose our souls. We should never short circuit enforcing the Voting Rights Act at every level. When one of us rise, all of us will rise. Justice is a way out. Peace is a way out. We should not act as if nuclear weaponry is negotiable and debatable. World in which we live, we dropped the bomb on Japan and felt guilty. But in 1984, other folks also got bombs. This time, if we dropped the bomb 6 minutes later, we too will be destroyed. It's not about dropping the bomb on somebody, it's about dropping a bomb on everybody. We must choose to develop minds over guided missiles and think it out and not fight it out. It's time for a change. Our foreign policy must be characterized by mutual respect, not Hot Rod Gunboat Diplomacy, Big Stick Diplomacy, and threats. Our nation at its best feeds the hungry. Our nation at its worst, will mine the harbors of Nicaragua. At its worst, will try to overthrow that government. At its worst, will cut aid to American education and increase aid to El Salvador. At its worst, our nation will have partnership with South Africa. That's a moral disgrace. It's a moral disgrace. It's a moral disgrace. Focus on apartheid in Southern Africa. We must fight for trade with Africa and not just aid to Africa. We cannot stand idly by and say we will not relate to Nicaragua unless they have elections there and then embrace military regime in Africa, overthrowing democratic governments in Nigeria and Liberia and Ghana. We must fight for democracy all around the world and play the game by one set of rules. In this world, our present formula for peace in the Middle East is inadequate. It will not work. There are 22 nations in the Middle East. Our nation must be able to talk and act and influence all of them. We must build upon Camp David and measure human rights by one yardstick. In that region, we have too many interests and too few friends. There's a way out. Jobs. Put America back to work. Now, as a child growing up in Greenville, South Carolina, Reverend Sample used to preach ever so often a sermon relating to Jesus, and he said, "If I be lifted up, I'll draw all men unto me." I didn't quite understand what he meant as a child growing up. But I understand a little better now. If you raise up truth, it's magnetic. It has a way of drawing people. With all this confusion and this conviction and bright lights and parties and big fun, we must raise up the simple proposition. If we lift up a program to feed the hungry, they'll come running. If we lift up a program to study war no more, our youth will come running. If we lift up a program to put America back to work as an alternative to welfare and despair, they will come working. If we cut that military budget without cutting our defense and use that money to rebuild bridges and put steel workers back to work and use that money and provide jobs for our cities and use that money to build schools and pay teachers and educate our children and build hospitals and train doctors and train nurses, the whole nation will come running to us. As I leave you now, and we vote in this convention and get ready to go back across this nation in a couple of days in this campaign, I tried to be faithful to my promise. I lived in El Barrios, ghettos, Indian reservations, and housing projects. I had a message for our youth. I challenged them to put hope in their brains and not dope in their veins. I told them that like Jesus, I too was born in the slum. But just because you're born in the slum does not mean the slum is born in you. And you can rise above it if your mind is made up. I told them, in every slum, there are two sides. When I see a broken remnant, that's the slummy side. Train some youth to become a glazer, that's the sunny side. When I see a missing brick, that's the slummy side. Let that child in the union and become a brick mason and build Vesta Sunnyside. When I see a missing door, Vesta Slummyside, train some youth to become a carpenter. That's the sunny side. When I see the vulgar words and hieroglyphics of destitution on the walls, that's the slummy side. Train some youth to become a painter, an artist. That's the sunny side. We leave this place looking for the sunny side because there's a brighter side somewhere. I'm more convinced than ever that we can win. We have fought up the rough side of the mountain. We can win. I just want young America to do me one favor. Just one favor. Exercise the right to dream. You must face reality. That which is. But then dream of the reality that ought to be, that must be. Live beyond the pain of reality with the dream of a bright tomorrow. Use hope and imagination as weapons of survival and progress. Use love to motivate you and obligate you to serve the human family. Young America, dream. Choose the human race over the nuclear race. Bury the weapons and don't burn the people. Dream. Dream of a new value system. Teachers who teach for life and not just for a living. Teach because they can't happen. Dream of lawyers more concerned about justice than a judgeship. Dream of doctors more concerned about public health than personal wealth. Dream. And priests who will prophesy and not just profiteer, preach and dream. Our time has come. Our time has come. Suffering breeds character. Character breeds faith. In the end, faith will not disappoint. Our time has come. Our faith, hope, and dream will prevail. Our time has come. Weeping has endured for a night, but now joy cometh in the morning. Our time has come. No grave can hold our body down. Our time has come. No lie can live forever. Our time has come. We must leave racial battleground and come to economic common ground and moral higher ground. America, our time has come. We've come from disgrace to amazing grace. Our time has come. Give me your tithe. Give me your poor, your huddled masses who yearn to breathe free. And come November, there will be a change because our time has come. Thank you and God bless you.